Welcome to the OIS Podcast, where you get candid conversations with the leaders and drivers of ophthalmic innovation. And now, here's our host, Tom Salemi.
Hi, welcome to the OIS Podcast. I'm Tom Salemi. This week, I'll be talking with David Mullick, President and CEO of Avedro. Welcome, David.
Thank you.
I'd like to spend a short time talking about Avedro as a business and to hear from you as a MedTech CEO of how you're getting by in this difficult market. I invite anyone listening who wants more details on the company. You've done a couple of great presentations at our recent conferences. So if you visit OIS.net and search for Avedro, you'll find the two great presentations on your full line of offerings. But I don't think we have the time to get into them today, but we'll certainly hit upon them. You've been on my future interview list right from the start of the podcast, but we reached out yesterday after you announced that Avedro would be acquiring IROC Intercross. This is the latest of a string of, I guess, somewhat low-profile acquisitions. I don't want to diminish them for Avedro, but what's been the plan? Has this been a slow effort to just build the company's critical mass and its line of offerings?
Well, I think it's, I guess I would describe, you know, things we've done as opportunistic. You know, we're in the cross-linking space. Anything that's of cross-linking interest, you know, is for sale or for license, whatever, usually passes by my desk at one time or another. So, we're kind of watching for opportunities to help really expand our offering into the marketplace to be able to deliver all cross-linking products to all possible customers that might want them.
Mm-hmm. And how bifurcated is this sector? Is there folks at every different price point that you're trying to reach?
Well, I think with the Intercross acquisition, we're picking up devices on the lower price point side. And beyond that, they have a fairly large installed base of almost 1,000 systems in the field. So those are opportunities for us to upgrade them. People have used those systems for years and years, to upgrade them to maybe a more modern, newer, fancier system.
Mm-hmm. And is this something that'll be sold by a single salesperson? Will they have all these things in their bag, so to speak?
Well, around outside the U.S., we sell everything through distribution network. So we have our own distribution network who currently carries our products and will now carry the Intercross products on a non-exclusive basis. And then retaining all the Intercross distributors that we can to keep the connection to their customers. So we're really increasing our distribution network by quite a bit.
Interesting. What's the competitive landscape like for cross-linking? Are you putting yourself up against other smaller companies, or is your real competition, you know, alternatives for the LASIK procedure, which cross-linking sort of enhances and works with?
Well, I think really it's an interesting competitive landscape in that at this point, we don't really feel like we have any real competitors. And that is to say, when I think about cross-linking, it's not simply a light device. It's a photochemical therapy that involves the proper riboflavin solutions, the proper metrology, and the like. So, other than Intercross, there are no other companies that have really spent any time doing any scientific or laboratory or in vitro research on what cross-linking is about. So, really, the other people that are out there that are competitive in our space really are those that have been able to, you know, cobble together a light box. But, you know, that's kind of where the surgery begins, and that really isn't all that helpful. So our mission here has been to build our critical mass with the science and the technology so that when a physician buys a piece of equipment from us and the riboflavin solution, et cetera, they're getting all the support that comes behind that from a broad array of KOLs around the world that can answer questions and the like. So at the moment, as I say, we don't really perceive we have, you know, real competition for what we're doing.
What is the market like, the penetration like? I understand we'll get into the issues in entering the U.S. market in a little bit. Sure. But in Europe, I know there was a physician at OIS who said it was a significant part of his practice. Has this penetrated deeply in Europe and in markets outside the U.S.?
Well, I think, you know, if I did the sort of the nose count on total number of systems in place that have been put in place over the last say, 5 years, 5 or 6 years. There may be as many as 2,500 to 3,000 systems around the world, which really isn't that many if you can take all of ophthalmology into account. And I think that the that, you know, whether it's every month or every quarter, we see that the indications expanding or the uses expanding of the technology. So I think it's still at a very early stage in outside the U.S. And as you sort of mentioned, where LASIK Extra are using the cross-linking in combination with LASIK has been, you know, there's a lot of hand-holding, I think, that took a while to convince in the more conservative markets that this was a good thing to do. But now, really, over the past year, we've really started to see LASIK Extra really start to take off in the European markets.
And of course, you're developing a competing technology yourself. Let me say, as a low myope, I love the pixel technology. This is great for cowards like me I like the idea of having intervention in my eye, and I don't mind my glasses that much. So I don't opt for this. But how huge is the potential for this product?
Well, I think, you know, we're still at the early phase of that, but I think that if it works as the early clinical trials indicate that it will, it should be as big or bigger than the current LASIK market. I think we really see the market in two places. One is the if you look at patients who are low myopes, -1.5, -2s, in that area. If you look at the demographics, most of the people that are nearsighted fall into that demographic group. But if you look at the people that actually have refractive surgery, they fall outside that demographic group. So the potential population to be treated is probably, you know, six times as large for the pixel procedure. And I think it offers somebody a much lower risk, non-surgical, non-contact procedure to reduce myopia. But there's a second half of it, which I think is, it may be even larger, is that the ability to gently tune up post-cataract ametropia. You know, most 45% of the patients that have cataract surgery are left with residual myopia and astigmatism, which is right in the target range of what this device should be able to treat. And so it lowers the barrier for the cataract surgeon who doesn't want to be a corneal surgeon. It lowers their barrier to add a separate modality to improve the patient result. So I do think the market for this is huge, and I think that kind of gets back to your original question about where's the competition. I think we're in a little honey spot here in that we're, for a whole variety of reasons, we're leading the charge with a technology with huge potential, but nobody really nipping at our heels at the moment.
Is this a one and done procedure, or is this something that's going to require repeat visits to the physician every
year? We don't know the answer to that at the moment. I think that, you know, we have part of the answer in that there are patients who have been cross-linked for pathology, or keratoconus patients, where you can see the treatments lasting 8-10 years. So it's too early to know if that's going to be the case in the refractive case. We haven't treated that many patients, the order of a couple hundred, to be able to watch them out long enough. I can tell you, though, that from the perspective, you know, many conversations we have with refractive surgeons that are kind of looking at this, I think that, you know, the general thought is that they'd actually prefer it, in a sense, if it was okay if it lasted 12 months or 18 months and needed a tune-up. I think it's it's different from the catch-and-release model that ophthalmology has grown with, but I think it's more like the Botox model where people pay to come back in to get a little tune-up. As long as you're providing good vision during that time and the procedure doesn't, you know, looks like it's probably less traumatic than getting your teeth cleaned. So actually the business model works if it needs to be repeated. And I think also from the patient's perspective, it adds more confidence to them. I mean, you're the nervous guy, if you think it's going to go away, then, you know, you're probably even more willing to try it, because if you don't like it, you know it'll go away. So I think it really works either way, but it's too early to have the answer.
I prefer to consider myself cautious as opposed to nervous, but
there you go.
I mean, it's almost like it's kind of a contact lens almost. You're putting it in there and you're taking it out. It'll go out at some point, but it's that same sort of business model. I mean, I've seen pictures of you wearing glasses in some photos and not in others. Are you just farsighted, or have you had a procedure done to correct your vision?
So I'm actually, I'm one of those people that the surgeons deny happens, but I'm a bilateral, fully regressed LASIK patient.
Oh.
So I know that there's a lot of talk about, that not happening, but at least with my data point of one, I know that it happened. So you see it all the time, but yes, that's me, bilateral regressed.
That's a man on a mission. We're going to take a quick break right here. We'll be right back.
OIS is now accepting applications for presenting companies. Share your technology and clinical data with over 800 industry executives, investors, and key opinion leading ophthalmologists. To be considered for the Ophthalmology Innovation Showcase, apply online at www.ois.net/application.
We're back with David Muller. Regarding the other interesting piece of your portfolio, I mean, it's all interesting, but the Brillouin spectroscopy, it was so fun, Brillouin, I fumbled the next word. Is this sort of custom mapping increasingly common in ophthalmology? I mean, we're seeing personalized medicine growing in all other fields, even orthopedics. What's happening here, and what's the potential?
Well, at the moment, really throughout all of medicine, there's no way to actually measure the biomechanics of do an in vivo biomechanics measurement of any body part, really. And I think that that is particularly in the case of the cornea, where, 20 years ago, nobody touched the cornea, and now over, lots of years of LASIK and other procedures, we've started to understand how important the biomechanics is of the eye. And this is really the first device that actually provides that custom mapping of the biomechanics. And I think, to the personalized medicine aspect, this will really play into the pixel procedure, in that when we learned how to do LASIK, we essentially, we could measure the front surface of the eye. We knew how much tissue we had to remove from the front surface to get a new shape. But with pixel, what we're doing is we're causing a biomechanical reshaping. And so it's not simply knowing what the front surface is. You need to know how thick the cornea is. You need to know its relative strength across the cornea, so that when I provide additional strength with pixel, I can get the biomechanics to move the eye the way I want. So this is going to be, I would say, an integral part of treatment planning to get the pixel procedure spot on. But beyond that, I think through the rest of ophthalmology, I think that because there are a lot of other places you'd be interested to learn about the biomechanics of the eye, whether it's the lens or the lamina cribosa, looking for, cataract and glaucoma type issues. If you can look at it and make those measurements, I think we're going to find those to be important. And I think, what's the future of Brillouin? I think it is on the way to becoming the next OCT in a whole variety of other areas. It provides a measurement that has never been able to be taken before. And with these kind of technologies, once they're in the hands of skilled doctors and surgeons, they're the ones that start finding those new uses.
What do you think will be the, I'm still in baseball season, the cleanup hitter of your lineup? Will it be Brillouin? Will it be Pixel? Is it your first product? What is your business plan call for really driving the company forward?
Well, I think it's, we look at both U.S. and ex-U.S., obviously there's different timings.
Sure.
But, the first thing is, obviously we're moving ahead on treating the pathologies. But I think the first wave of success is coming with LASIK Extra. We're using cross-linking conjunction with LASIK. And, even with, as the smile procedure starts to grow, we see people all over the world adding cross-linking to the smile procedure as well. So I think there's the first hit, which is going to be, restoring that strength that's taken away during general refractive procedures. And then that's going to be followed on by pixel, reshaping the cornea. We're actually, we're starting our first actual GCP study over in Germany now to look at post-cataract refractive treatments. And I think that was, we're looking for that to be a real springboard for us outside the U.S. The Brewet kind of is going to come along in parallel, and we're really looking at it at the moment as more of a device to help implement the refractive procedure as opposed to a standalone device, although I'm sure it will grow in that direction.
Mm-hmm. And where does the FDA going to play into this? I tried to figure out a way to incorporate a clip into this podcast, because at the presentation in Boston, you came upon the section of your presentation when you're going to discuss the FDA, and you just sort of released a deep sigh and just stared blankly into the audience. I think that pretty much said it all. Obviously, you've been frustrated at that point, having just received the response letter regarding the NDA for the riboflavin ophthalmic solution, the KXL system. I understand you need to be careful. You're still dealing with the FDA, but what has that process been like?
Well, you know, as you said, of course, it's frustrating because you always want things to happen tomorrow. Mm-hmm. You know, it's been interesting. I mean, I think that the biggest problem, I think, in dealing with the FDA is not sort of the individual issues. It's more that it just takes so much time, and because I guess they're relatively busy, that, you know, when there's a statutory date that's set, you generally don't hear anything till that date, and then, you know, then you're sort of at a start point again. But I think, you know, we're our third bite at the apple on getting this approved. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the first time, you know, we had purchased this study, so when you purchase something you didn't do yourself, it's not surprising it comes along with the little issues you have to deal with. And I think that, you know, the first issue that I deal with the FDA, I was disappointed, but understood, and, you know, we had to go back to the drawing board, so to speak, for a year's worth of remediation. The second time, you know, which happened in March, I have to say I was a little more disappointed about, because I was caught a little more off guard on that. But I think that, you know, we essentially were handed a handful of questions. But since that time, I think that the FDA, I have to say, has just been great to us. I think that they've responded to, we're in regular conversation with them. They've helped us through the issues of trying to solve this problem, get the answers to the questions they asked. And I think we feel like we're back on track for approval, hopefully early next year. And there's really been a change of a change in the interaction. As I say right now, it feels good.
I was going to ask anecdotally. At least we hear that things are improving. So your interactions today are more positive than the ones you've had in the previous years.
Yeah, I think, you know, we were at a meeting at the FDA, you know, probably a month or so ago. And, you know, typically in the past, those meetings, you know, you get an hour for a meeting, and the meeting can, you know, at the end, you're not really sure where you've gotten to, and because there's a lot of things to talk about. And we went down there, they had a whole team of people in, we brought our people, and the meeting lasted a half an hour, and we got everything done we needed to get done, and everybody was happy, we shook hands and left. So I think, you know, that was, when we left the meeting, we were all, you know, all of the people on our team felt like, you know, we were being listened to, and they were actually trying to help us move our way through it. It was a very good experience.
How gratifying was it to pull in the $43 million last year in a very difficult market? And perhaps you can give us some context there as well. Was that effort, raising that capital, the most trouble you've had raising money?
Yeah, not actually. I think the round before that was probably harder. I think it actually came together quite easily. I think, you know, partly because it looked at that moment we could see the approval in sight, so it made it somewhat easier. Mm-hmm. And I think that, you know, it was the kind of deal we turned away money. We could have raised more in that round. And, you know, to be honest, I was a little oblivious to the fact that it was probably the largest med device round in the prior 12 months, so I was so focused on what I was doing. But it really wasn't all that bad.
Well, it just ruins that question entirely. Thanks so much.
I think, you know, the environment is, you know, to raise venture capital, to raise it now, I think that, you know, I think there's a standard wisdom, which I think applies, which is that if you have something that's really good, you can find the money for it. And I think that's, you know, that's generally seems to be the case. And I think that, you know, some of the deals that are more marginal, that that look like they might be good, but they're higher risk, you know, they're not getting done for, you know, all the reasons we discussed, FDA, timing, all that kind of thing. But again, I think if you have a good property, then I think you will be able to find funding for it.
What is the biggest selling point for you? Is it just the huge market that's awaiting for you in the U.S. once you get this through?
Yeah, I think we have we have a huge worldwide market, and we're the only guys on the block. I think that, you know, over time, I think, you know, the past few years since we've been out here with this, that people have realized there's a whole number of applications, particularly in the refractive surgery side, that cross-linking is going to be good for. We have, you know, for the keratoconus, we've got a 7-year orphan drug designation on the drug, so we're for, you know, for that first indication, no other company can even be approved for 7 years. And so I think that we're in this very unusual spot where there's a very, very big market, and we're the only player in town.
Mm-hmm. And finally, I've asked this of everyone. What's your read on Google's entry into ophthalmology with the Novartis deal? From your perspective, you've been in this industry for a while. Are they really bringing fresh technology and fresh ideas to the table, or is it just are they just a different player with a similar approach?
I don't think, you know, the ideas that I've seen, I don't think are necessarily new and revolutionary, but I think they bring an imprimatur to it, which says, hey, this is really fancy technology. We're a very successful fancy technology company. We should be able to develop it. But I look at the particular offerings, you know, the contact lens is going to send signals everywhere. And I think there's, big technology hurdles that still await that. And I think there's, you know, market hurdles too. I think that, I'm not sure. I think it's a cool thing that they're doing, and I think it looks good, and it gets people's attention. But I haven't seen anything that looks to me like it's close to being, you know, a product. And by close, I've got the entrepreneur's view, by close is like 5, 6, 8, 10 years. I'm just not seeing it.
Well, we'll see how that turns out. David, thanks for taking a few minutes to chat to the OIS podcast. I appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thanks a lot for talking with me.
Great. We'll see you in Chicago.
All right. Good enough.
Thanks for listening to this OIS podcast with David Muller. We initially planned to bring you our interview with Stephen Slade, so we'll bring that to you next week. Stephen and I had a great conversation about the new technologies coming in ophthalmology. Please listen in, and we'll see you in Chicago.
Don't miss your chance to attend the next Ophthalmology Innovation Summit at AAO on October 16th in Chicago. OIS will showcase market-changing technologies and provide a forum for industry leaders to discuss and debate the challenges and opportunities facing this dynamic industry. Hear what world-renowned ophthalmologist and inventor Dr. Steve Charles has to say.
This is a great forum to get everybody in the same room. These are not separate parts of the puzzle. They've got to be a cohesive unit to work together. We can't see the FDA or the venture capital community as adversarial. They've got to be part of the process. And so this is dialogue. That's what this is about. And it was a very effective forum for that. It's the fifth time they've held it. It's also very effective in the spring at the ASCRS meeting. I'm delighted to be a part of it.
So visit the new OIS Supersite for more details and to register at www.ois.net.